Hello, everyone, and welcome to an evening episode of 42 Minutes. I think this is episode number 40, and today is the 10th of July, and Will is away, and Alan and I are speaking to Freighter X, who is going to bring a book out this year on Think Book Press called The Secret War on Freemasonry. Is that correct?
The Secret War Inside Freemasonry.
Inside Freemasonry. And you're also going to contribute to the Think Book Volume 2. My co-host couldn't let this slide, but the thing that he's interested in is William Morgan and how he almost destroyed Freemasonry.
Can we just point out, so the other host of 42 Minutes, his name is Will Morgan, so he has a personal sort of vested interest in this question.
That's his real name, Will Morgan?
Yeah, it's his real name.
Yeah.
Is he from New York?
No, he's from Colorado, I think.
Huh.
He's from Alabama, I think, but he lives in Colorado. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I know some about William Morgan, the captain who was... It was Palmyra, New York, I believe, and it was in like the 1820s. September 11th, as a matter of fact, is the day he disappeared.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's controversial. It definitely struck struck a fire of anti-Masonry that led to the first third party in America being formed, the Anti-Masonic Party. And, what I've gathered is this. From what I understand, and one of the main sources I draw from is a guy named Stephen Defoe from British Columbia, who wrote a book called The Compasses and the Cross, and he also wrote a book about William Morgan. It hasn't come out yet, though, I don't think, but he's referred to the research that he's done on this book in this Compasses and the Cross book. And what I gather is this, that William Morgan was someone who pretended to be a Master Mason in order to infiltrate a Blue Lodge and gain access to the Royal Arch chapter degrees and ritual, and then eventually become, so first he was made a Royal Arch Mason, and then he was made a Knight Templar. So those are both predicated on being a Master Mason first. So he faked being a Master Mason. He learned the passes and grips somewhere and got in there, and then was made a Royal Arch and a Knight Templar. And then according to the Masonic side of the story is that he became, he sort of like was a layabout, like an itinerant worker. He borrowed money and didn't pay back his debts. He used to get drunk regularly in his like Knight Templar blouse and regalia and sit around drunk in the square and, make a fool of himself, I guess, is what it was thought. And eventually it was exposed that he had faked the degrees of the Blue Lodge in order to get into the other, but nothing could be proved. It was sort of scandalous. And then he threatened and started to prepare his expose, which I have a copy, a digital copy of William Morgan's expose, which, the funny, ironic thing is his expose became a reference material for Blue Lodges after the fact. They actually used his expose for degree work to refer to while they trained for the rituals.
Because basically he's just detailing their rituals, correct?
Yeah, because he basically was like a monitor. He did like a William Morgan's monitor. And he didn't like accuse it of being anything evil. He just exposed all the degrees and everything. And so then the real controversy comes not when he disappears, but when the people who are accused of being connected to his disappearance are completely exonerated and let go. The people of the area found that to be an injustice. They considered it to be proof that there was two separate kinds of justice. There was justice for Masons, and then there was justice for the regular people, the profane, the uninitiated. And so that's what struck. And it like killed Masonry in a lot of areas. All the lodges in Vermont shut down, every single one. Almost all the lodges in New York, the entire state shut down. And it almost destroyed the Scottish Rite. It turned it into nothing more than a few scraps of paper, loose leaf papers with descriptions of rituals and floor work on them. And it made the Knights Templar completely revise their public rituals they did in public, the ceremonies they did. They used to have black triangular aprons with metal, shiny silver skull and bones on the front of them. And then they stopped wearing those because of the association with all the scandalous gossip that was being spread around, you know, like misinformation, disinformation, and everything. And so, another thing that happened, the biggest important thing I think that happened in the wake of the Morgan affair, that's what it's called, the Morgan affair. One of the biggest and most significant things is that the shift in charitable action within the lodge system. Up until that time, Masonry has a policy, and it's something that each Mason has to take an oath, an obligation to basically tend to other Masons in need. You're saying that if a Mason, a qualified Mason, somebody who's in good standing in the lodge and is no question about his character, and he comes up to you and he asks you for help, whether it be financial or otherwise, you're obligated as a Mason to help to fly to the relief of a fellow brother Mason. That is something we take oaths above and beyond many of the other obligations. That is a very highly held action when you become a member of a lodge. So the funny thing is, though, is that as soon as you take those obligations, it's almost as if you never took them, because I would say that here's what I saw. I saw a lot of lodges with very wealthy members and members who, like, were almost in rags. You know what I mean? Like, dressed, like, you know, they barely could dress nicely to come into the lodge, and struggled with financial burden to the point where, you know, it was like, is he going to show up to do practice for whatever? And it's like, no, he's got to work. It's a double shift to pay his bills or whatever, you know. And so that, to me, seems sort of like inequitable based on these obligations that were supposed to be held. But in the meantime, I think back in the day when I researched it, I found that back in the day in America, especially in the colonies times, Mason lodges were much more about tending to the needs of the brother Masons in a community, especially in colonies where they were starting towns up and starting communities up. So if you had like a brother Mason that needed a barn raised, you know, they'd be sure to come and help him, or, you know, there was a lot of mutual aid going on. And I think that they became known as, oh, they take care of their own. But after the Morgan affair, they turned their charitable arms outward to the community in tenfold, and I believe in order to put on a good face for the, you know, on a PR level, in order to undo the bad publicity that surrounded the Morgan affair.
Do you connect this also with the fact that it sort of forced them to reshuffle? Did this create a sort of power vacuum for Albert Pike and the Scottish Rite to kind of have their coup, as you sort of.
I don't know if I could say that was a deliberate action, but
I don't mean deliberate. I just mean, like, do you think that created an atmosphere where that was possible?
Well, what I think it did was it diminished the fraternal orders so much. Like, for example, the Scottish Rite was diminished to a point where it was almost forgotten about, and so a guy like Albert Pike could come along and take advantage of the structure of that right to build it into his own right, to make it his own vehicle, you know, in a political and esoteric way to establish his foothold within the greater Masonic organization. Because remember, the Scottish Rite, this is something that, I don't know if you guys are clear on this, I mean, it's something that's not clear to a lot of people. The Scottish Rite is not a free Masonic organization. It is in no way connected to the ancient craft masonry of America and of any country. It is an organization that predicates its membership on prospective members being a master mason first. So that's the only connection it makes. It claims that connection to Freemasonry. Freemasonry does not make that claim to the Scottish Rite.
And so, that's the secret war that you're talking about.
Well,
so,
the secret war I'm talking about distinctly is between the Scottish Rite and elements within the York Rite, specifically the Orders of Chivalry like the Knights Templar and the Knights of Malta, because the Scottish Rite requires authority and lineage, and it takes it from the Knights Templar tradition that already exists within the York Rite traditions.
You had described... you had described to me the sort of nature of the Scottish Rite, the way the Scottish Rite essentially takes control of the York Rite. You had described to me very much of that same, like, Confessions of an Economic Hitman type style, you know, financial terrorism of, like, the way the IMF operates. You compared the Scottish Rite to the IMF, the same sort of modus operandi of putting a Blue Lodge into debt and then sort of seizing control of it.
I'm really glad you made that connection. I hadn't even thought of that. That's an excellent book, obviously. I've read it, too, by John Perkins.
Yeah,
and
really good.
That is an excellent connection to make because it's exactly like that. You know, the Scottish Rite, over the course of the last century, has, I think, an incremental manner, and I plan to map it out specifically in one jurisdiction just to be an example. But what they basically do is they, among many other organizations who are all predicated on membership in Freemasonry, use the same Masonic buildings that were back in the turn of the century, the 1900s, you know, late 1800s and early 1900s, when fraternal orders in general were at their peak in America. And literally, I think I've heard numbers somewhere between 5 out of 6 or 6 out of 10 men in America were members of fraternal orders. So it was like an intense amount of people involved. And in cities and towns across America, they would have a common building, a lodge structure or a temple that would be owned by a corporation that would form of all the member bodies, you know, like the Eastern Star, the York Rite, the Scottish Rite, the Shrine. They would all have a share in the corporations. And so they would equally, you know, be able to determine the needs and the decisions of the facility, and they would share it in a democratic manner. And that's how it was established across America in many towns and cities. And if you look at them today, in many that I, at least the ones that I have, and I honestly haven't researched all of them, but every one that I've gone into personally, and then the ones that I've looked at deliberately, all reflect back to me the same situation, the same scenario over and over again, where the building that they used to own, and I do say, stress and many times used to own, has been shut down, sold off for its, you know, equity, and then a new building has been procured, either rented or purchased or built, and is in the sole control of the Scottish Rite.
So I'm sorry, I did kind of a poor job introducing you, but you're a researcher and you explore these topics on your blog radio show, The Middle Chamber. Is that right?
Yeah, thanks. So should I call you Doug or Douglas?
Doug's great.
Doug. Okay, Doug, thank you very much. Yes, I am on Saturday nights, 8 p.m. Central on American Freedom Radio, AmericanFreedomRadio.com. It's called The Middle Chamber with Freighter X. And as a matter of fact, this week coming up, we have Sean David Morton on, who's written a book called Sands of Time. And I'm really looking forward to that. It's really cool, like traditional kind of sci-fi story, Sands of Time. It's pretty interesting, all about like the things that we get a thrill out of, like Montauk Project and, you know, transdimensional devices and mad scientists and evil governments and all this stuff. But anyways.
That's actually an awesome tangent because when you were talking about the actual buildings, the Masonic lodges themselves, and particularly I think a lot of people in early what we call synchromysticism was this study of the World Trade Center being structured as Solomon's Temple. You have World Trade Center 1 and 2, the famous Twin Towers, as the stand-in for that Jachin and Boaz Twin Pillars, and then World Trade Center 7 is known as the Solomon Brothers Building. So the three, there's actually four buildings that were destroyed that day, but the three buildings that everyone talks about very much encode this Solomon's Temple structure. Now, I had, in my research for this, and I guess I should just interject, for anyone who's familiar with the work of Jake Coetzee, he had laid out this idea of the 9/11 Stargate, saying that basically not only was this Solomon's Temple, but that there was some sort of resonance, at least, with a interdimensional portal being opened, you know, on 9/11. Even if not literally so, a sort of resonance with it, with the movie Stargate and Escape from New York and all these different things. It's actually a really interesting area of study. But in looking into that specifically, I came across the classic, you know, Duncan's Masonic Monitor and Ritual. And Duncan points out that he says it's the Master Mason's Lodge is designed as Solomon's Temple. And I just want to know if there's a distinction between, are all Masonic lodges designed as Solomon's Temple, or if it's specifically for, I don't know if that's just a semantics issue or not, where he's saying it's the Master Mason's Temple is designed as Solomon's Temple.
Okay, well, there's so many things I wanted to comment on before you asked me that question. So I got kind of like, you know, hold on, let me put some things on the back burner here. The lodge reflects the structure of Solomon's Temple, absolutely. The distinction I think that you're getting hung up on is that each degree within Freemasonry has, you open a lodge in that degree. So you'd open a lodge in the first degree, or open a lodge in the second degree, or open a lodge in the third degree, and they each have a unique opening and closing ritual or ceremony involved, certain words said, like as certain passwords, and that's, you know...
But it's the same building.
Yeah, it's within the same building. So the confusion is there with the uninitiated. They don't realize when we refer to lodges, we're not just referring to different buildings. We're referring to different spaces within the same building. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's something to really keep in mind now. When you think about ceremonial magic, because that's kind of segues backwards into what you were saying before about the buildings alignment in the World Trade Center configuration. And I think that it is completely within the realm of my possible considerations. If I was a dark occultist and I wanted to engage in what you spoke of, opening gates between different dimensions, moving about in time and space, I would absolutely, and not just that, let's really focus. So I think we had this conversation before, and I think I've heard you speak of this on this show at other times with other people, that the point is that this ritual is being done in a very sacred spot, you know, a spot in New York City that was once the capital of America. That area, you know, right after the Revolution, you know, at the end of the Revolution, before Washington, D.C. was made the capital, New York City was. And so that spot is very significant to the civic mythology of our country, because didn't we hear some, and have we confirmed whether this is a fact or not, that Washington had actually gone to that spot, and there was a chapel once right there, and he had done some sort of a blessing to the nation at the end of the Revolution? I mean, that's a myth that I heard. I don't know if it's true or not, but the fact of the matter is that even if it's possible, that without that being specifically true, that area is historic to America and to Americans. And now if we're going to engage in this very, you know, intense ceremonial working, we're going to use the buildings themselves as furniture within the space, the magical space that you're going to, you know, transmute or convert into an area in which you're going to open up gateways or have a huge impact on the psyche of everyone around you. Because that's inevitably what we're talking about, the potential of a massive magical working, but in fact, the potential for the massive conversion of a mass consciousness of an entire group of people having their minds captivated and transformed to see things in a deliberate way through an action, through a giant demonstration, a ritual, you know, incantation, if you will.
So then this leads to a thought about intention and then possible control at the top of the pyramid structure. Do you think, I mean, where are your thoughts when you get into that area?
Well, I think that it always comes back to intentions. You know, the people, you know, what, you know, whether you have mercenary motives or just you truly are on a path to seek enlightenment.
Well, is there a power elite?
Well, you know there is. we're all living under the throne.
Well,
right?
Sometimes I wonder if it is, you know, we turned on this machine that's just running and we don't realize that there's no one in the driver's seat. But do you think there really is someone in the driver's seat and they are trying to accomplish certain ends with highly ritualistic type events?
I think that it's likely, because I think the evidence points, there's a lot of evidence pointing in that direction. It seems highly likely to me that a certain percentage of people within these organizations have that intention. It's like, you know, there's 1,000 bugs in the forest, right? And most of them are harmless, but a few of them are lethal, deadly even, you know? And so.
Can I just interject? Because I, having spoken to both of you at length separately, I wonder if you're both not actually kind of thinking the same thing, only there might be a little distinction here that needs to be made. So the idea of when Doug says the top of the pyramid, is there an elite? And Frater X is saying, yes, there is. Having spoken to you, I think you would make the distinction. There is what we might consider, if you look at that, say, $1 bill, there might be that 13th level might be this power elite. But that sort of ultimate eye at the top, this is where we actually get into spiritual and esoteric paths where of enlightenment, where you recognize a power, that your personal power above that, correct?
Are you asking me or Doug? Deckard?
No, I'm at Fredericks. I'm asking you. Like, I think I understand. If I understand correctly, that when Doug says the top of the pyramid, is there a power elite? There might be. I wonder if I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but if there's not a sort of nuanced distinction here that we could say, there is very high on that pyramid are some lethal people that are very intentionally trying to do things, and yet the absolute apex of that pyramid is not any external power structure, that this is where we get into personal paths of empowerment and enlightenment.
Yeah, I think it's that is safe to say. I think that I can only speak from my experience, and we can speculate, but I haven't personally witnessed much in the way of like the kind of evil, the you know, the worst case scenario that we could fear. I have witnessed simple acts of like what I would call treachery. You know what I mean? Like little backbiting political treacheries and deliberate targetings of individuals to like relegate or marginalize people, myself included in that, and groups within the organizations that would have influence and are deliberately marginalized in order to prevent them from having influence to keep things in a certain status quo. And so what that alludes to is the assumption that there is some elite at the top that are putting out directives to the underlings. And what we have is evidence in the lodge systems of different degrees for example, whenever every lodge system I've ever gone to, every grand lodge system that governs the entire jurisdiction, all the grand masters are invariably 33rd degree Scottish Rite, even though this is a blue lodge system. You know, like we're talking about the grand lodge of a blue lodge jurisdiction, so that's nothing to do with the Scottish Rite, but this guy is invariably a 33rd degree, as well as usually a high-ranking member of the York Rite and the other bodies, but he's always also a 33rd degree. And there's only 66 and 90, or 33 and 66, so there's 99 altogether of actual active 33rd degrees in the Scottish Rite Supreme Council. There's only 99 in the whole world. The other ones are what we call honoraries. So they're kind of like agents of the Supreme Council. They wear the white hat, but they're not really active, you know, members. There's a difference.
So would you, this is somewhat playful, but would you consider, all this sort of Occupy Wall Street, the we are the 99%, who are the real 99 that we're talking about?
Yeah, that's really funny. I hadn't even thought of that. That's really funny. Absolutely. I mean, it is 99. It equals 99, so that's really weird. And the funny, even to take it one step further, in the jurisdiction where I was made a Mason, when I was sort of taken under the wing by the guys who were marginalized within that system, they were only allowed a certain amount of sway, and they were never put in positions of authority, and they were never given political power. They were kind of like kept on a tight leash. But they were ritualists, and they were historians, and they were thinkers, and you know, real, what I would call mystical people, but they were being held back. They were part of what represents the ancient craft masonry, the esoteric side of masonry that's being suppressed within. That's the secret war inside Freemasonry.
Okay, that's the wonder. So right. It's not good guys and bad guys, but like tradition and then control, political control to utilize.
It does manifest as good guys and bad guys. It's kind of like the light and dark side of the Force, you know what I mean, Star Wars. It really does manifest that way. And okay. let me just follow the point, Doug, and then let's get back to what you're saying. But the point was is that we used to call the guys in this little demographic within the lodge system that I was made a Mason, the one percenters. That's what we called them.
That's so
They're
funny.
1%. They were like true believers, the real Masons. They were the 1%ers. Is that not funny?
That was
years ago now, 5-6 years ago. So now 1%ers is a whole different connotation in our society than it did.
So like,
let's go back.
This
to
is like a perfect thing because the occupiers are trying to reset civilization, basically.
Well, are they? Or are they just
trying to reset? And so, is it the same scenario where? Can you save masonry, or do you have to blow it all up?
Oh, I think that masonry is definitely on the decline, and it should be because it's bloated beyond its it's not really masonry. There are a lot of what I call minnows in masonry, masons in name only, minnows, and they just are little fish floating through the pond that don't really have. They don't even know what masonry is. They've been brought in under the wing of, like, the buddy system, like, group classes with, like, you know, 50 guys in them or whatever. And some of them have been, like, multi-generational ignorance, kind of. They were brought in way back when in the good old boys network. They never learned anything about masonry, and they think there's nothing to learn. And they told the guys that they brought in after that, who told the guys that they brought in after that, who told the guys that they brought in after that, that there's nothing really there. And so it's all, like, there's a deliberate... like almost seemingly unintentional suppression of esoteric masonry going on right there. And it's like because of the growth spurt that happened in the 20s in America, and then it reached a peak in like the 50s and 60s, and then sharp decline. And it's because the baby boomer generation rejected all the fraternal orders because it was part of the establishment as far as they were concerned, and they didn't want any part of it. So there's a giant gap in the membership now at Freemasonry. It's like me and my grandfather's age guys. Like without the baby boomer generation is just now starting to trickle back into the lodge systems. But it's really a giant gap, an age gap. So you have like grandfatherly guys and guys that are younger, like 30, 40 years younger than them in the lodge system now.
Well, I got to say, I'm excited for this book. It sounds like it's going to be fabulous, where I can learn a bunch of stuff. I have lots of gaps in my knowledge about masonry, but then also it sounds like there's some pretty interesting little details, nuggets that you've got out of here.
Well, you probably sense, too, that the overarching theme of it all is this secret war on human consciousness. It's just that this whole story of the secret war on Freemasonry is like a great little like model, a model of what's I think going on in our human society, you know, and it's that dumbing down process we hear from the John Gatto camp, you know, and the deliberate, you know, commodification of our culture, the consumerism, the mass production, industrialization. It's all, you know, it's part of the process of keeping us from ever really fully realizing our true potential. And, you know, the idea that we've been told our whole lives that, like, oh, 90% of our DNA is shut down. We only use, you know, 10% of our brain. The rest of it's just we don't know what that's all about. Well, I mean, I've come to the conclusion, guys, that, you know, I think that somebody shut our brains down. I think we were taken offline, like, probably 10, 12,000 years ago, and then, like, brought back online at the safe mode. Like, we're bringing them all back online on the safe mode. Like the consciousness is now on the safe mode. And it's like a Chinese model of reality, you know, like the Chinese model of the Internet, all firewalled. So you only have this small little picture of reality. It's only 10% of the scope, and everybody's focused on that, ignoring the whole giant picture around them.
Well, with that note, I'm going to actually have to go offline, and Alan's going to continue on. So thank you so much, Frederick. This was a great 42 minutes. I don't know how many minutes it's been, but I really enjoyed speaking with you, and we'll have to talk to you again when your book gets nearer and we can get to know the story a little better.
Well, Douglas Bowles also is going to be coming on my show after a little while and talk about his work.
Right? That sounds like a deal.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you guys have a good night.
You already sent me your book, so I'm thinking that's an invitation to come on my show.
Okay, I'd love to.
We'll talk about it later. Have a great night, Doug.
Thank you.
Bye, Doug. Thanks. Okay, wonderful. So when you talk about this idea of, you know, sort of being taken offline, is this, would you argue that the true Masonic tradition is the exploring and accessing that other 90% of the brain?
Absolutely. I think that the whole point of all the occult sciences and all the you know, mystery traditions and everything is about inviting transformative change and accelerating evolution of the individual consciousness.
Yeah. That's why I guess I was trying to make that distinction earlier of when we say who's at the top of the pyramid. I think ultimately the everything that I've gathered from any esoteric idea is that, you know, there is an external power, like any external power source or any external anything only goes to a certain level. And then it's up to you to try and empower yourself and to, you know, when I say enlighten yourself or educate yourself, however we want to word it, that if you can try and start accessing these other realms and spiritual concepts, that you're to take yourself to the top of the pyramid. Right? There's an I at the top of the pyramid for a reason.
I think that's actually like a more positive way to look at it, Alan, than, you know, usual. But I think that going with the literal, fearful concept of the direction that Doug was trying to take us with the what's the elite at the top of the pyramid. I think that it's very important to recognize that we're dealing with an elaborate game of misdirection, just like any, you know, street corner magician would do.
Right.
Where it's, that's really what's going on. That's why the Wizard of Oz is such a powerful archetype. Don't pay attention to the guy behind the curtain. You know, pay attention to the face of Oz blowing smoke and fire and loud booming and everything. That's what we're, you know what I mean? Don't pay attention to the guy behind the curtain. Even in the Bible, you find that it's almost like the Wizard of Oz there, where, like, you know, look at God's feet in the cloud. You know, it's always like this, don't look at his face, you know, like pay attention to the loud cymbals and trumpets and fire and brimstone, but don't, you know, don't avert your eyes or you might see through this elaborate misconception, right? But or misdirection, if you will. But so
I feel that very strongly. I mean,
for
all the, you know, I've heard different interpretations over the years of, you know, the idea of Moses going to the top of the mountain, and I've even heard ideas that it's a UFO because there's a thing in there where they say, like, you can't touch the mountain. Anything that touches the mountain, you have to destroy. So I've heard theories that this is a UFO contact, that they're afraid of, a contagion, some sort of biological quarantine, which actually is a pretty interesting interpretation. But whatever you want to take it as literally, what it really seems to me is some guy saying, hey, I'm going to go over here and talk to God, and he's going to tell me what's up. You got to wait here. I'll let you know what he says. Then you go over there, you twiddle your thumbs a little bit, and you come back, and you go, okay, God says you have to give me the finest robes and all your gold and silver, and these are
the best cut of meat, the best cut of the meat out of your flocks there, you know?
Like, if I was the guy, you know, I'd be like, listen, we just overthrew a pharaoh, go fuck yourself. You know, like...
Well, but, you know, putting aside the, levity there, but in reality, it was... I think this is a continuing game plan.
Right.
It's the misdirection combined with the hijacking of human consciousness. You know, something happened 10 to 12,000 years ago. Something huge happened to humanity. I don't know what it was. Probably a worldwide cataclysm or a series of cataclysms. But it sent us collectively reeling into, like, post-traumatic stress disorder as a species. And in the middle of all that, I believe, a group within our own species and probably without, you know, from without, got together and made a move, made a power grab. And that power grab was, okay, follow us. We're the builders. You know, we know how to rebuild. And they use, like, even the mud from the very flood to rebuild structures and bring us all back online, like I said, in a limited fashion. And they said, God told us what to do. And he told us to set up a special room where we're going to go talk to him, and only the elite priesthood can go in there and speak to God. You know, everybody
exactly.
else has to hang out back and wait for the words to come down the pike. You know, and that's where the trouble begins right there. Because it's like, dude, that guy's not going to tell us the story. He's going to tell us something else. You know, knowledge is power. We all know how this goes.
Right. And that, see, for me, in my opinion, I don't think it necessarily has to be a specific, like, passing down of, like, that the power has always stayed in one hand. It's just, this is a trick that works. That,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like,
that's my point. Yeah, you get it. Because we see generations of different civilizations rising up and falling, Persians, Greeks, Romans, all through this, you know, histories. But the game plan remains the same, right?
Correct. So like George, what did George Bush do after 9/11? God told me I have to invade Iraq.
He talks to God.
Exactly.
Like through a reed screen, like Arshavinipal or something. What's going on? Like up past Shem of Neo-Assyria? I mean, what really?
Yeah, and you know, and the idea is like, well, that's funny because God, you have a sort of confirmation bias there because God must have been sitting in on your meetings from the years before when you had already planned to invade Iraq. You know what I'm saying? Like, so,
totally.
You know, I mean, we can take this very literally, but I guess my, you know, hey, we can expose an actual corrupt motive. My thing is like, I've seen a lot of people make the case of like, ah, look, so here's George Bush doing the same thing. This is evidence of him being part of this, you know, sort of lineage, whether that be pharaohs, Hyksos kings, however you want to take it, that obviously, look, they're doing the same thing. But I think the point here is that, like you said, the street magician can do that same thing. He's not necessarily a descendant of a pharaoh. He's just knows that, you know, you can fool people. Here's an easy way to fool people. What is, you know, Aleister Crowley does a thing in I think it's Book of the Lies, where he references the, like, how, you know, how do you want to make a lot of money? Pay me this much money, and I'll teach you the secret to be a wealthy man. And everyone gives him money, and then he sends them a postcard that says, do as I do. Right? It's like, yeah, okay, you know, if you want to be powerful, you scam people. It works.
Yeah, just pretend you possess something that they need, and they'll give you their money, you know? that's the bottom line.
Right. And we see it in every corporation saying, you know, I remember, you know, a time when people didn't need bottled water. They convinced everyone you need to have a bottle of water.
Oh, yeah, it's all about that perception and perceived value and perceived need, and, you know, branding the product, perceiving the need. It's all there. Very, very carefully. I don't know if you caught it, but last weekend, Jordan Maxwell, you know who Jordan Maxwell is?
I do, yeah.
He was on Santos Bonaccio's show, which is on several networks. He also happens to be on American Freedom Radio, but he's on several networks, Mr. Astrotheology. But Jordan Maxwell mentioned that all the missionary organizations around the world are all funded by petroleum companies.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense.
And then they went on to talk about the chief financial officer of the Jehovah's Witnesses and how Jordan Maxwell asked him point blank how they paid for all the Watchtower endeavors, like $66 million in the 1 year that he was talking to the guy in just salaries alone worldwide, not including all the other services they provide. He's like, where does that money come from? And the man told Jordan Maxwell that the Watchtower or Tract Society had an open-ended account with Chase Manhattan and J.P. Morgan. So basically they received a checkbook every year and they could write whatever checks they wanted. They were all cleared. They were all covered.
Huh.
I mean, that was an amazing claim. I don't know if it's, you know, how we can verify whether that is accurate, but wow, I was like sitting there stunned thinking to myself, wow, you want to talk about deliberate, you know, the whole point of it, the millions and millions of dollars that the petroleum companies had been giving was for missionaries in the Amazon basin.
Well, yeah, because it's like saying, hey, go in this area and tell everyone that, you know, there's God is white and he wants you to love, you know, capitalism and eat McDonald's and
rend unto Caesar. What is Caesar? Right?
Yeah.
Bottom line, it has served us well, this myth of Christ. That was what Pope Urban said back in the day. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, well, so you don't want to mess with a good thing.
Yeah, totally.
But, yeah, I mean, so this is the interesting thing. Like, I think this is why I always sort of have one foot. And there's an esoteric, it seems to me, there's a lot of people that are interested in esotericism that really just want to focus on inner journeys. And I, of course, think that's hugely, immensely valuable. And then there seems to be this other sort of conspiracy crowd that only wants to focus on, hey, let's go through the accounting records of J.P. Morgan and see what shady stuff they're doing. And I think that's immensely valuable. But what I think is really interesting that I see happening more and more is this sort of combination of the two, where we're learning that, hey, wait a second, it's important to know, you know, if there's a scam, that you don't get suckered into the scam. You know, so it's an important sort of distinction of knowing that external game, if you will. And then there's this other thing of non-gameplay, to use a sort of Timothy Leary expression, but, you know, that sort of non-gameplay of stepping outside of it, and that's when you're having your spiritual contact, your exploration, your, you know, divine moment. And rather than being, you know, these both have immense value. And I think there's this really interesting thing happening where I see these sort of two realms kind of playing with each other. And, you know, it's almost like a left brain, right brain, where there's sometimes there's butting heads, but ultimately their best, the best use of them is to work together. And this is, you know, your show is called Middle Chamber. I know that's obviously a reference to Masonry, but there's also that idea of the middle pillar, or that sort of middle way, which is a very sort of balanced and all-encompassing, holistic approach to things. And I think this is an area that more people, I'm just hoping to see more of this in the future. This is really uplifting to me.
Yeah, man. I'll tell you, it's been an exciting ride, and more people are realizing the truly positive aspects to a lot of things that we've been too scared to even consider and look at for a long time. But I'll tell you, I agree with you that you know, there's a place for identifying, especially the machinations of the dark occulted elite, you know, out there, the global power elite. There's a place for it. One of the main positive sides to looking at that material and understanding how they've pulled the wool over all of our eyes, one of the main positive aspects of that is it simply begins the process of dispelling the collective enchantment that occurs from civic mythology and magic, literal deliberate magic being cast upon young minds in little history classes across America, you know what I mean, where they create this myth of America in our mindset, which serves to literally govern our psyche, you know, there's various key words that are used to activate specific emotional and psychological responses to certain ideas later on in our lives. It's all, you know, carefully imprinted upon us. And these, the process of the road back from that brainwashing is through the discovery of what's really going on. That everyone that, like you, me, Andras, all the folks involved in SyncBook, all the people involved in all these radio shows, all these people all got there through the slow, grueling process of unraveling the onion, you know, and realizing, oh man, look at all these lies, look at all this corruption, look at all this crazy, you know, deliberate and obvious subterfuge going on right in front of everyone, and everyone is completely blind to it. What the heck's going on, you know?